KALW.
But I think too often people come to their apathy out of a sense of like, I don't want to have a beer with that person. And it's like, that's not the game we're playing.
Personal preference is a growing driver of voter apathy.
So that's something else that falls back on the leaders of our community of, we want our saviors, but nobody's showing up at them schools.
Today, how youth mentorship in Oakland can push back. Then a molecular biologist is bringing African dance and music to schools.
My earliest memories are music, dancing, song, all ingrained as part of our day-to-day lives and activities.
And we hear from a local author. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. As part of our election coverage this year, KALW is listening to what community members want to hear and amplifying the work of other local news organizations. For Juneteenth tomorrow, KALW Elections Production Manager Johanna Miyake went to an event co-sponsored by Oaklandside and Capital B, a Black-led national nonprofit news organization, was part of Capital B's Black Political Power Tour. KALW's Hannah Baba spoke with Johanna about how Black voters in Oakland are now thinking about elections.
So, Johanna, what is the Black Political Power Tour?
So, Capital B is visiting 7 U.S. cities to talk about the issues that matter most to Black voters, their beliefs, their attitudes related to the election. They'll look at where Black political power is being eroded and where Black leadership is on the rise.
Mm-hmm. And so what was going on at this event you went to in Oakland?
Well, about 150 people came to Oak Stop in downtown Oakland for panel discussions with community leaders and experts. People had a chance to engage with each other and some local civic organizations that were there.
So what did organizers say were some general trends among Black voters right now?
So for that answer, I want to go to one of the panelists at the event.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy Ross is from Frontline Solutions. She was born and raised in Oakland, and she talked about the political temperature of Black voters.
About a third of Black voters are what you could call the rightful cynics. They're the folks that are like, well, I voted for Obama. Obama was in the office, Trump was in office, Biden is in office, nothing has changed in my neighborhood. I don't think any of our options are good. There's about 20% that you would call the next-gen optimists who are like, I think that the system can work for us. I want to push and work within the system. Sometimes I vote, sometimes I don't. And that's over 50% of Black people who you might get their vote, you might not. The other 50% are, more the loyalists. They tend to be older Black folks who have said, I'm very pragmatic. I'm with Biden because he's my guy, and I've seen how this country works.
Okay, that's interesting.
She also says this last group holds the belief that if they don't hitch their wagon to a candidate that can win, they're not going to have any political influence.
So, Johanna, we hear a lot about voter apathy, but what I'm hearing from you is that it's much more complicated than that.
Right. So it's interesting because it's often assumed that older Black voters will show up and vote Democratic, and younger ones are just apathetic. But Tracy Ross said there are good reasons for voter pessimism.
You can't shame people into voting, and you can't say the other guy is going to be bad. Again, if you feel like your life has not changed materially from president to president to president. I think that being an apathetic voter is actually a logical stance. It takes a lot to remain optimistic, I think, in these times. And it takes a lot to be hopeful if you're dealing with broken promises, if you're dealing with communities that are not safe, if you are hopeless, why would you hope? And I think that that's why it cannot be for a political season. That you come in and all of a sudden you care about Black people.
And she said the way to engage Black voters is to be involved with people on the ground all the time, not just during the elections.
And I think that if the political infrastructure, campaign infrastructure is smart, they will get connected to the folks that are doing the hard work. Because if you actually care about, you know, making change in communities, the hero of the election cycle cannot be the politician. The hero of the election cycle has to be the people.
So what other election-related topics did they talk about at this event?
Well, they talked about the difference between voter apathy and voter attitude. So apathy being voter fatigue or indifference, and attitude being more about why people vote the way they do. Mm-hmm. Omar Wasaw is an assistant professor of political science at UC Berkeley. He warned against political celebrity and people voting for who they want to have a beer with.
I want people to not invest in the person of, like, whether you like or dislike this person. I want people to think about, like, the debate that is at its core. Are we going to be a multiracial democracy, right? Or are we going to fight for some sort of ethno-nationalist, like, state that rejects the idea of multiracial democracy? Like, a lot of political science that says it's not even rational to vote, right? Like, you're gonna spend all this time and you're gonna have no influence, so, like, why would you do that, right? So apathy is, in some ways, like, the most rational thing. But I think too often people come to their apathy out of a sense of, like, I don't want to have a beer with that person. And it's like, that's not the game we're playing.
So, Johanna, that's kind of a big picture overview of Black political power. And so let's zoom into Oakland a bit. They kicked off their tour in Oakland. What's specifically going on in the town?
Right, Hannah. So a lot of people associate Black political power in Oakland with the Black Panther Party. It formed in Oakland in 1966, and the power then was that the Panthers were working outside of white institutions. So, like, a decade later, the election of Oakland's first Black mayor, Lionel J. Wilson, in 1977, kind of paved the way for Black politicians in the eastern part of the San Francisco Bay Area. David Peters is the founder of the West Oakland Cultural Action Network and the Black Liberation Walking Tour. He reflected on Black power in Oakland.
And so in the context of a generation of white flight leading up to 76 and Oakland becoming so much more Blacker, it was a very optimistic time in Oakland. And so I would tell you that it was the first best time to be Black in Oakland. Everywhere I went, people were talking about Black pride and Black is beautiful and Black. There was this flowering of culture. And so I would say, as important as Black political power is, Black power is more important, longer lasting, and more omnipresent.
And one way that Black power has shifted is with population. In 1980, Oakland was about 50% Black. Today, it's about 20% Black.
So, Johanna, what did activists say was most important in Oakland today?
Well, what's interesting to me is the younger Black community activists that were on the panel, they clearly hold many of the same values as people from earlier generations. They're looking at how coalition building has to evolve to meet the challenges Black communities face today. This is Sanyika Bryant, a political education organizer at the Black Organizing Project.
We'll be better positioned, I think, to act within those coalitions, right? When we have, like, a certain level of unity, but particularly class unity, right? Like, that class struggle, I think, is one of the key areas where we need to be focusing in on building actual organized power. Most of our people are in the East right now, in the deep East of Oakland, dispossessed, a lot of different organizations afraid to go and talk to folk. And I think that focusing in on pulling them in, inviting folks in, not throwing folks away, right? And rebuilding that social relationship between each other, I think is super critical if we're gonna be able to, like, effectively combat, you know, these powerful forces that we're contending with today.
So lots of ideas and thoughts, but were there any specific actions that people suggested?
Yeah, so some of the panelists focus on Oakland's Black youth and the need to engage them directly in political work. This is Maya Whitaker. She's the executive director of the Bay Area Urban Debate League.
So I think that there's a real disconnect when people are talking to our young, that you have an expectation of where they should be, and they're just not. So go cry about it and meet them where they are. So that's something else that falls back on the leaders of our community of, we want our saviors, but nobody's showing up at them schools. So these are where your kids are who need to learn how to be politically invested.
She really advocated for people to speak candidly with kids about money.
I don't know why we're so shy about a financial conversation, but do you understand you need to be making 136,000 to stay here? So why are we acting like that? Oh, I don't want to talk about money with the kids. Well, that's why we're getting displaced out, because they don't even know what they're up against. So I would say when it comes to organizing for us with political power, especially from my mindset with the young, is stop talking to them about how you used to do it, what you used to have. They don't have it. You ain't never moved somewhere where the rent started at $2,400. Never. You have no clue what they're going through.
Okay, Johanna, that is powerful, powerful statements. Thank you for going and for sharing what you learned at this event.
Thanks for having me on today, Hana.
That was KALW's elections production manager, Johanna Miyake. You can find our election coverage at kalw.org/elections. While you're there, take our survey. Tell us what you are thinking about ahead of the election. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba. Next, another segment from Hana's series, Diaspora Stories. Today we'll meet Catherine Ndungu Case. She's the co-founder of Cheza Nami, an award-winning African arts organization based in Pleasanton. Catherine is from Kenya. She's a molecular biologist, and for the past 13 years, she's led Cheza Nami in pioneering African dance and music in school assemblies across the Bay Area. And every year, they've held their annual award-winning festival, Taste of Africa, in Livermore. KALW's Hana Baba visited Ndungu Case in her Pleasanton home to talk about African dance, music, and cultural diplomacy.
So I'm in your beautiful home, and music is all around us. And, you know, there's the guitar, there's a grand piano, and then more guitars. And it's just, oh, yes, and string instruments from back home.
This is a 21-stringed kora. It is not tuned. It's an African harp from West Africa. This particular one is from Burkina Faso. This was made for me by Mr. Salif Kone. He is an incredible Burkina Faso artist. He goes by Malima Kone. But it's a 21-stringed. It's not tuned. And I don't know how to play it, but I love it. It's absolutely beautiful.
Gorgeous.
And we'll start taking some classes with him.
What role did arts play, like, in your home growing up? What kind of, was there music? Was there dancing? Where did this come from?
You know, you'd spend your days doing subsistence farming or doing just activities that were integral to life. And with that, music was very instrumental. So if you're thinking about going out and you're sweeping, you're singing a song, and just that's what I remember of my grandma and my aunts and uncles as we were doing chores around the house. This song actually is one that every single person from my linguistic group should know. It's a song that especially is about raising children, and it goes something like this, eh? Go show, ne go show, show. Osho nego shosho di kamena di meri adira mamaga dira mamaga mosharyo geda mamaga nita netena kya jahe moro aduto heyo ahe hi heyo.
That was beautiful. What was your schooling like and your kind of career path that you chose?
I was actually studying business in Kenya before I moved here in college. And while I was here, like any immigrant, right, I was cleaning houses, I was taking care of people's babies. I happened to be taking care of this one neurologist in Berkeley, taking care of her daughter. She needed somebody to help out with her clinic. So I started out doing that. And before I knew it, I'd gotten sucked into the scientific industry and was back in school studying cell molecular biology. And I've been in the drug development field ever since.
How did you go from molecular biology to the world of arts and music and starting Shezanami?
Kids. It is cliche, but my kids were the impetus for starting Shezanami. As they were growing up and really starting to embrace this idea of playfulness and music as part of our daily lives, I realized, why am I teaching them like songs that are not of my people? Like, there are all these nursery rhymes that are super fun and super easy to catch, but why can't we do that with like Swahili or like a song that is representative of something else that they don't normally have access to? And so I actually started out a Mommy and Me dance class for my kiddos. It was a Mommy and Me African music and dance class. I'd bring all these drums into a room and other parents with their kids would come and join selfishly because I wanted my kids to see that it is normal and cool. So Shezanami actually started as an exploration program where we could expose little kids, tiny, tiny kids from like crawling babies to before they go to preschool. There was this thing around when we go to the parks, right? We're standing out, right? Folks are very curious. It's like, well, you look like that. I've never seen somebody like you and your kids. It's like, oh, wow, look at them. They have curly hair. And so for me, I had an urgency around normalizing who we are, what we look like, the things that we listen to, the languages that we speak. And the only way that I could figure to do that and do it fast with a model that is sustainable was to invite other people to be a part of it, right? I don't know about you growing up here in the U.S., being here in the U.S., right? There's this thing about us as African communities is like we're always welcoming people into our homes. So when there's a cookout, who's cooking the food? Who's inviting people over? So it was sort of that sense of we're cooking this music and I'm cooking this, you know, repertoire of music that I want my kids to listen to and stories I want them to read, but I want the community to be a part of it because as they grow, it becomes their normal.
I love that. Because then they're not growing up in this bubble, because that's what a lot of us mistakenly do, I think. We grow up, we need our own spaces, but then we're having kids who grow up in this bubble and you're not sharing it with the outside world. And then they're seen as other. And also, I feel like we have a responsibility to share our cultures with others.
This guy right here is my favorite. This is the bala. This is the original piano.
The original piano.
Yes. It's made out of planks of wood, and there are hollowed out calabashes at the bottom that help resonate the sound. Different size pieces of wood that are small size all the way. Bala, and I'm still learning how to play that.
Ooh, you're still learning? That sounded amazing.
Still learning how to play that.
What happens at an assembly or at the library? What do you do there?
So our school enrichment programs include our school assemblies where we visit school sites and we conduct whole school performances. So we'll have the entire student body sitting either in an NPR or in one of their gyms, and we'll bring our Chezanami ensemble to showcase our dances, and we invite the school community to join us in the celebration, because Chezanami, the name of the foundation, is Swahili for come play with us. So we believe in a play-based approach to education. So our performances are not about just people sitting and watching. They're about, if we're dancing, we're going to invite you to dance with us. We're going to show you. We're going to facilitate the process, but you're going to do it with us. If we're drumming, you're going to drum with us. So those assemblies are like 45 minutes. So you can imagine they're very fast paced. People are standing up, sitting down, singing, dancing, calling and responding, coming up on stage, trying on some clothes, dancing with a partner in the room. And for 45 minutes, we'll just really take folks on a journey where they explore what a group of people who are different from one another, because if you talk about Africa, you're from Sudan, I'm from Kenya. You speak a different language. The way you dance is different than for me in Kenya. But imagine if we come together and showcase that even though we're different, we can join in our differences to create something beautiful and new.
When you're there at an assembly, at a school, for example, and all of these little kids who are not African are engaged and dancing and drumming. When you look around, what does that feel like for you?
It feels like unity. We will see a group of kids walk into an assembly, just not looking like they care, looking bored as hell, bothered to be asked to be there. And when they're leaving the room, it's usually a buzz of excitement. It's just like this buzz noise making kids just, did you see? Oh my God, I moved. Oh, and did you see him or her got called up to the stage, or they got an opportunity to hold a rhythm on your own, and we had to, that was so cool, that was sick. So it brings this euphoric sense of connectedness to a school site when we visit. And it's so elemental and simple. Like, there's nothing to it. All we're doing is working and partnering with these artists who've done this since they were born.
Your kids are now growing up.
Yes.
Do you get a sense that they are proud to be African? It can sometimes, for our kids, be hard to be proud.
A month ago, I had a parent send me a photo. It was actually a video of my daughter. She goes to a school that has about 2,600 students. And in the middle of the gymnasium with one of, I don't know what they were celebrating, she had drums and she had her friends drumming with her, and she was leading a drum showcase. And she was proud. She didn't care that most kids have never seen this drum and it looks weird. In high school, you can get ostracized very quickly. Like, that does not bother her. But it's the fact that she's like, this is something that I'm, and she said, Mom, we played the rhythm that you came and taught us when I was in fourth grade.
She remembers it.
She remembers it. But her friends went to class with her in fourth grade, and they also learned that rhythm. So they were playing together what they remembered. So now it's not just them playing something that is being introduced by my daughter. It's them playing something that they learned together when they were growing up.
So the plan worked.
I would like to think so. Well, they're still only 16, so I don't know what's going to happen the next 2 years, right? It's like, but I think what I'm saying is to parents out there, show up in your communities, in your wholesomeness, and allow the community to see the beauty of who we are, and welcome the community to be a part of the conversation. It will work to the benefit of your children, because then now you normalize who they are.
That's Catherine Ndungu Case, founder of the African arts organization Chezanami, speaking with KALW's Hana Baba. If you'd like to book them to come to your school, we've got a link at kalw.org/crosscurrents.
Naido Dubabu, Bira Amina. Naido Dubabu, Bira Amina. Zeretimia, Zanrobe. Zeretimia, Zarobe.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Sunni Khalid in for Hana Baba. Next, a humorous guide to making the most out of your home by doing the least amount possible. It's a reading from New Arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour. Allison Throckmorton lives in Menlo Park. Her book is The Good Enough Guide to Better Living.
The coffee table, landscape of the soul. Whether chaotic or highly curated, the expectation is for its objects to be picked up and mauled by whoever is sitting on the accompanying couch, chair, crate, floor. The following are some examples and ways to think through your curated space. Oversized photography books, coasters, and a candy dish. This landscape speaks to an aspirational adulthood that doesn't quite exist. It exudes culture, hospitality, and a passive-aggressive request that one not get watermarks on the table. The candy dish is a whimsical touch, a nod to the halcyon days of childhood when candy dishes were bursting and waistlines weren't. Scattered cereal, broken crayons, and sippy cups. A home with these elements requires guests to tread carefully, and not just because plastic toy bricks are likely lurking on the floor. The inhabitants here are on the verge of either a nap or a meltdown and need support. Offerings of food and babysitting are welcome. Commentary on domestic matters and parenting are not. One used contact lens, a wad of crumpled receipts, and a sock. Despite initial appearances, this too is an expertly curated space, though this landscape lacks both the refinement of the first and the harsh realities of the second, it possesses a je ne sais quoi that speaks to someone probably having a lot more fun than you. Do not underestimate this home. They are living and likely laughing and loving too.
That was Menlo Park author Allison Throckmorton. Her book, The Good Enough Guide to Better Living, came out in March. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. Today's team includes Aaron D.T.S. Nair, Zen Iqbal, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Gonady Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adel, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Suni Khalid.